I have been mirroring software into places whose name I cannot pronounce.
Oh my gosh, this sounds awful. What have you been actually doing?
I feel really embarrassed every time I pronounce this. I think it's Forgeo.
Uh-huh.
I think. It's not Forgejo, which I think is how it looks on page to us silly Brits. So I wanted to do some testing of the Forgeo Snap. And the Forgeo Snap is a thing that I've been maintaining for a while. And it's a Git Forge, like GitHub, GitLab, Launchpad, lol, and others. It was a fork, I think, of GitT, which was a fork of GOGS, I think. Oh, there's some lineage going back. Yeah.
So when you say it's a Git Forge and you say it's derived from GitT, I never used GOGS, but I'm familiar with GitT. Like, how much of a Git Forge is it when you compare it to something like GitLab and GitHub, where you've also got like all of the runners infrastructure and, you know, CI/CD stuff?
Yeah, it's got all that.
Really?
It is amazingly comprehensive. Huh. It's got a familiar user interface, so the usual buttons across the top, and then when you're looking at a code view in front of you, you've got, you know, folders with files in, and you've got the URL at the top where you can choose to clone something over HTTP or over SSH if you prefer. More on that in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it just looks familiar. And I'm not using it in anger at the moment. I've only got it on a very low power machine, as in low CPU compute capability. It's good old classic HP microserver from the past.
Oh my gosh, they're really putting their shift in, aren't they? That was what, like 12 years really old are. Now or something?
Yes, something like that. So I did a snap install for Geo, and then there's not much you need to configure. You can connect it to an external database if you want to. I've just got it using SQLite, which is good enough for me. And you could create an account. And then one of the interesting things that Forgeo has is you can mirror other forges. And so this is what I'm using it for, is I have added an entry in there to mirror some repositories on GitHub. And it has a built-in capability where every so often it will go and check and then pull any changes down. You need to give it an API key, otherwise it will blow up your free API call limits on the other end, probably, which is GitHub in my case. And I've got a personal access token, so I just gave that to Forgeo, and then it's able to just pull code. If I log into Forgeo and have a look at the user interface, I see activity is lots of mirroring going on, lots of pulling. Now, the reason I've done this is just, you know, I thought it'd be a good idea to have my code somewhere else, just in case something goes wrong. But also, it's just testing, and I thought it was a bit of fun.
So this is really interesting to me. So I want to do precisely this, and somewhere in my to-do list of things to do one day, I've got set up Forgeo and mirror my GitHub projects. And for exactly the same reasons you've just outlined, donkey's years ago, some jobs back, we originally had, can you remember, Track and SVN and all the rest of it?
Yes.
We were running that internally, and I migrated it all to GitHub at some point, and it was in the early days of GitHub. So being a little bit like cautious about what might happen, I was doing something similar to, you know, mirror all of that stuff. And I want to do it with my own projects at home, not because they're the primary source I'm going to develop them, but I just want that peace of mind that if something catastrophic happens, I have that stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, when all things considered, one of the richest companies in the world is running GitHub, and probably it won't go away. But I'm not just thinking about me. I'm thinking about telling everyone else about how to do this, because it's actually not that hard. One of the interesting things is I've got quite a lot of repositories in my GitHub account, and you can go through the point and click user interface for Forgeo and point it at the URL and paste in bits and pieces. But that's actually quite time consuming when you've got more than, like, say, 50 or more repositories that you want to mirror. Some of them are quite old and they don't get touched for a long time, but I'd like to keep hold of them. And so I went looking around and found the documentation for the Forgeo API. And so I thought, well, if there's an API and the API allows me to create a mirror, then I'll try using that. And sure enough, it does. I did one call to the API and you give it the URL that you want to pull from and the API key for the other end and your API key at this end to authenticate you on your API this end at Forgeo. And it just did it. It just worked. And I thought, well, if it works once, it can work 50 times. So I then ran my good old stalwart GH, the GitHub command line utility, in order to pull a list of all of my public repos.
Right.
Because you could filter it public or not, or private. And I thought, I'll just get all the public ones for now. I got the list. And then I created a little shell script that just ran through the list and just called the Forgeo API over and over and over again. And it just printed out each time it had done one. And by the end, yeah, it took a couple of minutes, not long, it was done. And then I just left it alone. And I logged in this morning, and sure enough, I can see updates to repositories that I've touched, like, for example, Nerdy Day Trips. That I can see the updates to that. And I can see updates to other repositories. I actually thought initially I'd mirror Sift and Gripe from work and see how that worked. I thought, they're nice and chunky, I'll pull those down. And that worked fine. And so now I'm seeing all the updates to company stuff in my Forgeo locally. I'm not actually doing anything with it at the moment. Mm-hmm. All I've done is mirror and then just go and look at it and make sure it works. But it's just me trying to find my feet with Forgeo and make sure it's robust enough for me to poke around with, really.
And so that sort of catch-up mirroring, the keeping things in sync, is that like on a pseudo cron timer, or is that like an event driven thing where if something changes in the upstream repository, it just bursts into life and pulls it down? Do you have any idea?
It is scheduled, but there's APIs at both ends,
right?
So I could quite easily have a thing that, you know, triggers with a webhook or whatever. The thing is, my Forgeo is not publicly accessible, so you can't see it from the other end, so I have to pull rather than have it push or trigger. But I could have something at home on the box which looks for changes, but I don't need it that much up to date. I just do it regularly. The other thing I wanted to do was, once I've got it on there, it's no good just sat on my microserver. What if I want to clone the repo down from Forgeo? Like, I want to, you know, use it like a normal Git forge. Mm-hmm. And because it's on my internal network, I haven't even bothered configuring SSL. And I thought, well, this is all a bit weird. And I think I'd probably rather use something like SSH to get the clone the repository down. And so it was pretty straightforward. I can put my SSH key, my public half of my SSH key, in my account on Forgeo, just like you can on any other Git forge. And then I can use Git clone. Although I thought I could, but the thing is, the Forgeo SSH server is off by default, I think. But anyway, it uses port 22 by default. And obviously the machine itself is using port 22. So I had to change the configuration in Forgeo, but that was easy. It's all documented. It's just a couple of options in an ini file that's buried somewhere in the snap configuration directory. Put the server to auto start, tell it to use a different port, and then I can git clone popey at whatever the host name is, colon, whatever the port number is, and then the repo, and boom, all it comes down. It's surprisingly straightforward, really.
So there's obviously a convenient snap for people that are running Ubuntu and snap-compatible distros that you've been maintaining for a while. For anyone else, like, how much moving parts are there in Forgeo? How hard is it to, like, you know, stand up and install? You've obviously got an insight into what's required to package it and operate it.
Yeah, Node and Go, basically.
Really?
There's not a lot to it. Yeah. As long as you've got Node and Go. The only reason I know that is because when I built the YAML, I had to specify what the build dependencies were. And so I had to put a particular version of Go and a particular version of Node. And sometimes the upstream Forgeo project will bump the Go dependencies or the Node dependencies. And that's happened a couple of times in the last, I think I mentioned this maybe a little while ago when I mentioned doing some maintenance on snaps. And it's not been a lot of hard work. And I test it and it works. Now, I don't know that everything works because I don't use every possible feature of Forgeo. So it's possible that some part of it might get stymied by snap confinement or the directory structure or some other thing. I don't know, but I haven't tested that. But someone else no doubt can tell me. It's all detailed on the thing. And I'm not really looking to, like, get loads of people getting the Snap. It's just a convenient way to try it out, really. If you want to try it out, use that. If not, use Docker, you know, or maybe Bare Metal install, because it is actually quite easy to set up. But yeah, I just wanted to mention that it is out there and you don't have to use these big corporate backed GitForges. And the team are really nice as well when I've interacted with the people in the project. They've been really, really pleasant to interact with. So it's a really good project. So if anyone's looking for a self-hosted forge, I can highly recommend Forgeo.
I have just started adding just to some of my projects.
Was that in the name? Oh, it's just Quick Emu. It's just Quick Get. What is just?
Just is, as they describe it, a handy way to save and run project-specific commands. So just is the command that you run at the command line. It's implemented in Rust. It works on Linux, macOS, Windows, and most of the other platforms as well. And it's kind of like a simpler, easier to grapple with replacement for make. And I have always struggled with make, and particularly the make file. I've always found it a bit challenging to work with. The syntax of the make file has never really sort of jived with me.
Is this that M4 thing, or is that send mail, isn't it? Or is make, I don't know.
M4 is one of the macro languages that like the autoconf tools use, but Makefile has got like all of those weird idiosyncrasies, like, you know, phony recipes and all the rest of it, which I've never fully understood. And I've sort of cargo culted stuff over the years. And I've often wondered, what the heck am I typing and why am I putting these weird incantations together? But I was drawn to Rust because I've seen a few other projects using it. I think the first time I was really sort of, I really saw it was when I was contributing to Bluefin and Bayesite, I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago. And they use Just to manage all of their build configuration. So what I liked about it is that you can create a file called the Just file, which describes the recipes, and it's a great way to instrument your project in an easy to manage and easy to understand single file, so that when you have common like build, run, or debug commands, which maybe have a whole bunch of flags that you have to, you know, learn, rather than memorizing those, you can encode them. So instead of having to run, you know, a whole bunch of switches and parameters to some build tool, you can just replace that with Just debug, and all of the necessary stuff that's required, you can build into that recipe. And it just looks like, I suppose, like a simple GitHub action or something like that.
I was about to say, like, it feels like GitHub actions are human readable. Yeah, it's a file format that you can kind of figure out. And this sounded like something where you're trying to describe the steps required to do a job, right? And you just want to say, just do this thing, and hit somewhere in there, there's some magic voodoo that just goes and picks out the bits you want and does them, right?
Yeah. And there's nothing magical or voodoo about it. It's really quite straightforward. I mean, the Just file is very clever. So it's self-documenting. So ahead of each recipe, you can put a comment, so hash and some words, and it automatically turns that into the help syntax for that configuration. So if you run Just inside a project, it will list all of the recipes and use that comment to tell you what they do. And it automatically auto-completes your recipes. So I first used this to replace a whole bunch of sort of Nix derivations that I had in my Nix configuration to handle building and deploying my Nix configurations. And I was able to replace, I don't know, 8 or 9 derivations in Nix with this single Just file, which doesn't require any clever configuration. Just itself is a single binary and it's easy to install. And once I'd done that, I've then started adding it to other projects. So for example, my website is built using Hugo. So in my website project, I now have a command which is just serve. I don't have to remember what the Hugo syntax is to build and serve the URL, but it does an extra step, because not only does it do the Hugo build, it also then runs XDG open for the port that my configuration is on. So it automatically opens the browser rather than me having to click on the URL.
Oh, gosh.
I know.
Such work. I mean, you could also add in there like ngrok or
right.
Tailscale funnel or like whatever way you want to make it available on other machines
exactly.
by some method and integrate that in there as well.
Yeah, because I can never remember on Tailscale whether it's serve or funnel.
Yes,
so all you need to do is like, you know, add a just publicly expose recipe yes. and just bury all of that into this recipe and never have to remember how to do it ever again.
It's funny how this whole ecosystem of things that are improved over make, mm-hmm. right? But there's such a long tail of projects that, like, nobody wants to attack them, you know, to I don't mean attack the project. I mean attack the task of replacing make. I know when I first started at Anchor and I was looking at Sift and Gripe and I was running make, and it turns out there's some magical voodoo and they use something called task instead because they don't like make.
Right.
And so there's some magic that when you run make, it actually runs task underneath it. And so you still get the outcome you want.
Mm-hmm.
You could have a make file that just runs just, right? So you could do make public and then that would just run just and like you're done. And I think there's something you could do there to make it pleasant for the people like us that like the new stuff.
Yeah.
And the old guard who are fans of make, maybe.
Yep, you could absolutely do that. Because one of the clever things with just is the recipes can be written in any arbitrary language. So you could write your recipes in Python or Node. So if your project is a Python project or a Node project or a Ruby project, you know, you can keep that sort of familiarity for developers and contributors to the project by having all of the just recipes written in the language that's common to the project itself. I've just been using it in the, here's a series of, you know, commands to execute in sequence. And it works perfectly fine for that.
Nice.
And it turns out, I don't know how long this tool has been around, and I'm sure there are people listening to this thinking, oh, well done, Grandad, you've just found this tool.
Or Whippersnapper. Is Whippersnapper picked yeah, this new
get
thing
off
up.
My lawn.
It's not new.
But all of the code editors and IDEs have full support for the just files, syntax highlighting and completion and linting and all the rest of it. So it doesn't matter what you're using, you can install it. It's in every package repository for everything that you use to get software from. And I've just found it delightful to use. And what I'm just starting to do with it is I'm starting to move common like development local workstation development recipes that are I have in common with CICD. So in the upstream documentation there are two GitHub actions that provision just in a GitHub runner, and once you've got that, then you don't have to have like those long sequence of commands in your GitHub actions, because your first step is provision just, and then you can say just build or just deploy or whatever it is, and you can then reuse all of these recipes that you've created for development workflows and sort of chain them together for CICD related stuff as well.
Yeah, I do like this idea of the misconception that your local development workstation is anything like the machine in the cloud that's running your stuff, or the machines in the cloud that are running your stuff. And it's often like stuff will work on my machine, but it won't work in a GitHub action. I have to like get frustrated and have to redo it again. But I like the idea of reusing one set of config and not having to write the same thing twice in two different ways, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And so for my Nix configuration, which is common for my Linux machines and my macOS machines, just is the single syntax, the single recipe that works on both those platforms. I don't have to account for, am I on Linux or am I on macOS? It just works wherever I happen to have that configuration and wherever I execute it. It's very simple. It's extremely well documented. It's a very active project. So if you're looking for a way to sort of build a simple set of recipes for your project so you don't have to remember all of these incantations for different things, really take a look at just. It's really great.
I've just been on holiday for a week in the New Forest.
Ooh.
And I took with me my new car.
Ah, do they have many trees with power sockets in them down there?
No, they do have power sockets with power sockets in them, fortunately.
Well, I know this because my sister lives down there and I've been down there and my battery has been completely dead before I come home. But yes, what was your experience like then?
Well, I stayed on a holiday park, which helpfully caters for people with electric vehicles such as myself. So that wasn't a problem. We made it down there, used about half the battery on the way there, about half on the way back. And I charged once when we got there, once before we left, for a week's worth of poodling round. No problems, really.
What's to worry about? End of show.
But I thought we could talk a bit about my new car, because it's quite nice.
Is it? Is it nice? What is it? What'd you get? What'd you get?
I got a Volkswagen ID3.
Ooh, they look quite nice. I see a lot of them on the road. They're very nice.
Yeah. As soon as I ordered one, I was seeing them everywhere suddenly, so they seem to be quite popular. But they sort of look like a bit like a Golf, but with the nose chopped in half.
They're a bit squarey, aren't they?
Yeah. So unlike my previous car, which was a Citroen EC4, this is only available as an electric vehicle. There's no petrol engine version. So yeah, that means that they don't need as much space under the boot for the potential engine, which will never be there. But also the thing that really struck me was the amount of space there is inside the car, because there's not so much space needed for the bits that you need when you have an engine in there.
It's interesting, that whole generational change from a car that is basically a modified fuel car into a battery-powered car, and now the next generation is totally battery-powered car, is exactly what I've got with my Mini, because my previous one is a petrol car converted into a battery car, kind of. And the one I've got now is just battery car, and it does make a difference, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, what I really noticed was how much more storage there is everywhere. And like, the bit where the gear stick and everything would be is now just storage and cup holders. And then where that would sort of morph into the console at the front, there isn't anything. There's just a little pocket where I can put my sunglasses, which is, yeah, quite nice. It feels, even though I think the car itself is slightly smaller, it feels more spacious inside, which is quite nice.
What capacity battery is it?
It reports 250 miles when it's fully charged, which is 50 miles on top of what my old car said.
What's that in kilowatt hours?
53-ish.
Okay, so it's about the same as my Mini.
Yeah, so it's been doing, it says, an average of 4.7 miles per kilowatt hour. I think that's the measure, isn't it? Which is more efficient than my previous car as well.
That is certainly the measure that I don't look at, yes.
But yeah, I mean, the way I think about this is I need to stop and recharge before the car does. So that's fine as far as I'm concerned. If I'm ever doing a journey that long, I'll never get to 250 miles without needing to stop one way or another. So yeah, it's got a bigger battery and it's more efficient, so it has a longer range. It feels, I don't know, just an unquantifiable nice to drive factor. It's a bit nicer to drive, like to be sitting behind the wheel of, than the previous car. Nothing particularly wrong about driving the previous car, but I just find this one feels a bit more whizzy, if you like. It certainly has more bells and whistles. I mean, and this is stuff that's not necessarily to do with it being an EV, just to do with it being a new car. Things like adaptive cruise control, where you can just say, go at this speed, follow the car in front at this distance, and then you take your foot off of everything and you let it ping pong between the lanes without staying. I didn't do that. Hands on the wheel at all times.
Yes. One of those little weights hanging off the steering wheel so you don't have to hold on to it. Yeah, I've seen those. Yeah.
In terms of also getting the most efficiency out of the car, if you put it in eco mode and you put it on adaptive cruise control, I found the way it accelerates is a lot gentler than my old car. Before, if you put it up, so you increase the speed of the cruise control by 10 miles, it would go vroom and get you there. Whereas this car gets you there a lot more gently, which then means it's not draining the battery as much with the acceleration, which I think is quite neat.
Mm.
It also has a predictive speed management feature. So if it knows you're coming up to a lower speed, rather than waiting till you get to the speed sign and then braking, it like changes the limit about 100 metres back, so you gradually slow down, which is quite neat as well.
Yeah, I've noticed my Mini do that. It, You can see the little signpost on the dashboard, and then behind it is like a kind of grayed out the next speed zone coming.
Yeah.
And before that one comes to the front, you can feel the car dropping in speed, so that as it crosses the threshold, it feels at the right speed.
Yes.
That's pretty clever.
And the other thing is that lets it use the regenerative braking more smartly as well, rather than you slamming your foot on the brake at the last minute.
Do you have the regen braking on all the time? Is it a thing you can like switch on and off easily?
Yeah, or? So it just has a drive mode and a braking mode. It doesn't have like fine tuning of that, but I find I feel more in control with it on. So I tend to go with it on because I'm used to it now. It feels more like
a go-kart?
No, I was thinking it feels more like the control you have when you engage the clutch on a car with a clutch. You know, that sort of biting point and that control you have of the speed at that point. I feel like when you've got braking mode on, it has that sort of bite to it more, which makes me feel like I'm more in control than if I'm just letting it fly off as fast as I press the accelerator, you know.
Yeah, I agree. And you feel like you can time it right. If you take your foot off, you'll come to a coast stop
exactly
at the lights or up against the next car, not quite up against it.
Rather than just the weight of the car carrying it for as long as it wants, yeah.
Yeah.
The other big thing I think that I noticed is that as a plus is the software that the car is running is far more competent. Like in my previous car, it was almost just an afterthought. Oh, we need something on here. Let's like cobble together a few bits and bobs. But this, it might be running Android Automotive. I can't tell, but it certainly feels kind of like an Android tablet kind of experience.
What makes it feel like Android?
A few of the sort of the icons and the interface bits and the particularly when you go into the settings menus, the way the settings menus look, if it's not Android, it's certainly aping Android quite heavily in that regard. But I haven't found anywhere that it says, you know, other than, you know, copyright things in the open source software bit where it shows you.
You look in there as well, do you? Yes, I do. Of course. I look for my friends' names in there all the time.
I didn't scroll that far.
So you talked about it being maybe possibly Android. Has it got an app store in it where you can download or slash buy additional applications that go into the car?
I think it does, but I've not actually looked at that in any detail because when I'm actually driving, I use Android Auto from my phone because my phone has all my music on and it's just easier to do that because, you know, there was a bit of a couple of weeks in between the car, this car and my old car, when I had higher cars, and it was much easier just to have the entire setup on my phone, unplug it from my old car, put it in a higher car, drive around for the weekend, take it out, put it in the new car. It's all the same. I've got all the same apps there. So I haven't really spent much time actually configuring it to use as the entertainment part of the infotainment system. But in terms of going in and finding settings and changing the car's features, or accessing the car's features, I should say, it's certainly a lot easier and more intuitive to do that in this car than it was in my previous car.
It's interesting that this generation of cars, my previous one, I would have on Apple CarPlay all the time because the internal maps were terrible and I just didn't like the user interface.
Yeah.
The Mini I have now, while it supports Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, and the OS is Android, because if I look in the store, this is why I asked about the store, you can see some names that are like reverse DNS, like Android-y style app names. The UI is so much better that I actually don't use Apple CarPlay other than for the podcasts that are on there. But I then start a podcast playing and then switch to the car's internal UI, the map is just so much nicer and the whole interface is just so much better. And it really surprised me because I was very much, oh, no car will ever have an interface that's as good as the Android or the iOS one. Well, I was wrong and this one does. And I'm surprised, really surprised they've done a good job.
Yeah, maybe I should actually give it a go next time I'm on a long journey, see how I feel about it. There are a few things which I think could be improved or were better in my previous car. The climate control system is a bit less flexible, a bit less adjustable in terms of where things are blowing. There's no fans in the back, which is a bit annoying when you've got kids in the back. And the actual like turning things up and down, it's all touch panels. Before I had twisty knobs, which I liked, but this is all like touch slidey things, which aren't as good. And you can accidentally put the fans on full whack and blast yourself in the face by accident. If you tap in the wrong place, which isn't ideal.
I recently found out that mine has the Amazon Lady Cylinder voice.
Oh, really?
And yeah, if you enable it, you can then start barking orders at it. And that's one way in which it is, it's got a built-in assistant, like, hey, Minnie.
Yes.
And it, this little thing goes, and never gets the right answer. But if you ask the Amazon Lady, she is bang on, right, first time and faster right. than the internals, and to do the fan stuff. I've started using that instead of the touchscreen buttons, because I'm not a fan of that non-tactile touchscreen thing. It's a shame that that's a thing.
Yeah. One thing that I found particularly odd, especially having just gone away on holiday and had the family in the car, been hopping in and out a lot, you can't leave the infotainment system on when you get out of the driver's seat. It sees you leave and it turns the car off.
If you're the only person in the car?
No.
Oh.
Even if there's other people in the car still, even if you leave the key in the car, your phone is still plugged in the car. As soon as you get out of the door, it turns off.
Hmm.
Which means if you want to leave it playing music while you nip into the shop, for example, for the rest of the car's occupants, it won't do that unless you then lean back in and press the ignition without sitting down and then lean back out again.
Can you not just press the power button on the radio and it come back on again?
No.
Oh, but that's every car I've had ever, is it tries to be clever and turn off when you get out of the car, including the one I currently have.
Yes.
But as it turns off, if you just hit the button and turn it back on again, as you walk away, it stays on.
I don't think the central panel has a separate on.
Oh.
The screen comes on. If when you get in the car, before you press the ignition, the screen comes on and says hello and lets you say, yes, it's me. But it doesn't have like a, yeah, anyway.
These are very much the first of first world problems,
yes.
Aren't they?
Yeah, it's just really odd that I found. Maybe I can adjust this. The other thing that was a bit strange was that I think you might have mentioned having this problem with your Mini in the past, or your previous Mini, is that it had a bit of an argument with my smart charger at home when I tried to connect it up to the car's APIs. And so it knew what level of battery the car had, and then it tries to smart charge, and then the car says, oh, now this is my level of battery, and it goes, oh, well, I can't charge anymore for some reason. And so I had about 2 days of not being able to charge the car, and I looked up in the instructions, it said, well, if you're having a problem with this, maybe just try unpairing it from the car for now. I did that, and hey, everything worked.
Yeah, mine sends me notifications all the time telling me, it's stopped charging. Me, you should check your charger. It's probably broken. Right, no, it's not. It's just, it's giving me, shut up.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
it's funny how these, like, super intelligent things, all, they are the main character. They can't possibly allow something else to be, like, in control. It's wild.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm only 2 weeks in with this car, but I feel that, after having just stress tested it on a family holiday, I'm justified in you know, giving it a mini review now. So we'll see if I discover something amazing about the software system, we might have a chat dedicated to that in the future. In the meantime, I'm happy with this car, definitely. I think it's an upgrade from my previous car, and I'm looking forward to continuing with it for the next few years.
Have you done, or is there possible, any kind of API access that you can noodle with in Python or something where you can get data and show it in Home Assistant or on your desktop? So, you know, you get icons and stuff showing you how your car is charged and all that kind of stuff. Like, I know there is in the Mini world. I don't know if there is in VW land.
I know from having paired it with my charger, there is an API that can be accessed by third parties. So watch this space, folks.